to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Jacobs, and I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. I want to encourage you to participate in today's program, which you can do by clicking on the button at the bottom of the screen that says Q&A. That's your spot, and we really welcome your questions. As you'll see, they're an important part of our conversation. You'll also see next to the Q&A button, live transcript. If you would like that service of a closed captioning service, just click on it and you'll get that. I want to welcome you to today's program, The Battle for Congress, What's at Stake in the Upcoming Election. Our moderator is Professor Catherine Pearson, who is here at the University of Minnesota, where I'm located. Her work and her commentary and research are on the United States Congress, congressional elections, women in politics, and her current research is looking at the pursuit of power in a partisan era by women members of Congress. Catherine Pearson, thank you so much for moderating today.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you all for being here today. Joining me for today's conversation is Professor Wendy Schiller. Wendy is the Howard R. Swearer Interim Director of the Thomas J. Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, a professor of political science, professor in international and public affairs, and director of the Taubman Center for American Politics and Policy at Brown University. Professor Schiller did her undergraduate work in political science at the University of Chicago, served on the staffs of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Governor Mario Cuomo, and then earned her PhD in political science from the University of Rochester. After fellowships at the Brookings Institution in Princeton, Professor Schiller came to Brown in 1994, and she teaches courses on the American presidency, American political process, and Congress and political and public policy. Professor Schiller, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
It is great to be here with you on sort of with less than a week out before the 2024 elections. And it's especially nice to talk about congressional elections. Of course, we'll get into the race for the White House as well. But so much is at stake here with congressional elections. We have a Republican majority in the House by only 4 seats, one of the most narrow margins in history going into a presidential election. And Democrats control the Senate by 1 seat. And so before we start talking about each chamber and what we think might happen and why, let's sort of step back for a minute and talk about why we're in this ultra-competitive position, where the race for the White House will be decided by 7 swing states that are currently all too close to call within the margin of errors, if you look at polling averages, and the House and the Senate are so close. So can we talk a little bit about sort of the partisan divide in the electorate, the near equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, and the increasing importance of party loyalty when it comes to voting in the electorate?
Well, you know, these are all really great questions. I'm not sure we're going to have as much time as we would like to answer all of them, Professor Pearson. But when you think about divide, I think there is a divide in 2025, in the 21st century, you know, going into January of 2025, thinking about what government does for me. You know, Americans seem to have 2 different visions or versions of what government does for them. The Republicans have been selling the idea that government is, you know, not that good for you, that it's big and it helps other people, and it doesn't help you, and you have to cut taxes and cut spending and cut everything. And the Democrats are saying, no, actually, government's turned into this really useful tool to help you, you know, with healthcare, with education, with job training or availability of jobs, job creation, building affordable housing. There's really this very stark difference. If you go back to 2000, this is what this election really reminds me of, 2000, because there was portrayed to be a pretty big difference then between the Bill Clinton, Al Gore team and the George W. Bush, who was governor of Texas, you know, version of what government should be. So I think this, it's not 2016 to me, it's really 2000, where there's a turning point. What do we want it to be? Is it too big, the federal government? I think there are problems with both arguments from both parties. The Republicans sort of make that argument, but if you notice, they haven't shut the government down lately. Why? Because Americans are so intertwined with the federal government. We rely on the federal government for everything: our road safety, our food safety, obviously Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, affordable care, all these things that are really dependent on a functioning federal government. So the idea that you want to shrink it all or get rid of it all, it's just not realistic anymore. So I think there's some disingenuousness there. And the Democrats point too quickly to government as a solution. You know, let's the federal government will pass a law, everything will be better. And of course, they don't label their laws very well. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act was about environmental policy. I don't know who thought about that title, but that wasn't very smart because Americans don't think it has anything to do with the environment. So there, the Democrats overreach on what government can do for people, and they frequently under-deliver, not necessarily in fact, but in the minds of a lot of voters. So I do think that the choices that are framed in the election on the ground, I think it's a very different ballgame. And there just hasn't been a lot of explanation of which policies we really need and which policies could stand to be reformed.
Right. Thank you for that great insight. And of course, these days, when Americans think about their opinions on policy issues, sort of their partisan loyalty to one party or the other, their partisan identification, sort of that precedes their public opinion on various policy issues. So everything is seen through the lens of partisanship, and we can certainly see that playing out in this election. Thinking about the Inflation Reduction Act and of course, West Virginia and Senator Manchin and how that was important to him, and he was the linchpin of that compromise. And of course, his seat is now open and now leans heavily Republican. So let's talk about the U.S. Senate races. There are 34 seats up in 2024, and Republicans have a massive structural advantage. 23 of those 34 seats are currently held by Democrats, many of whom won in 2018, they all won in 2018, 6 years ago, when Democrats were having a really good midterm election 2 years into the Trump presidency. So, as I said at the outset, Democrats currently have 51 seats, but they're defending 23. Can you talk about the race for majority party control in the Senate?
Well, first, I want to give people an inside look to the differences between Professor Pearson and myself and how we think about the Congress. So I made my career in the Senate, working in the Senate, and writing about the United States Senate. Professor Pearson made her career working in the House of Representatives and writing about the House. So let's go back to Joe Manchin a little bit before we talk about the actual elections for 2024. It is a distorting reality that one senator from West Virginia can shape an entire policy for the entire country of 338 million people. I understand that. So the way that the Senate distorts the policymaking system is really important. And the fact that we only have 100, we have two from each state, but they're not elected at the same time, and we still have a legislative filibuster, meaning they can delay things. So it's a really old-fashioned framework, and we have a 21st century federal structure of government. So, we have to really think about a system where one person from a particular state with particular interests can really shape a whole national policy. On the other hand, the House is gerrymandered so badly that very few House districts are competitive. State legislators, after the census, they make it so that the majority party can win more seats in the House in that state than the minority party in the state legislature. So we have a situation where there isn't really competition except in primaries, which intensifies somebody's partisanship. So I think the House, because of gerrymandering and so many safe districts, overemphasizes loyalty to the party, whereas the Senate overemphasizes loyalty to a particular person or a particular state. So going into this race, you can see that in action, right? The House is competitive. It is possible the Democrats take the House back. Maybe not probable, but it's possible that they win 12 seats and they, win the majority. Theoretically, in the Senate, we already say, well, it's gone. It's going to be Republican because Montana, John Tester, is a Democrat in a very red state. And senators can, for a long time, get away with that, per se, meaning they're a little bit more liberal than their constituency because they deliver on agriculture or ranching or environment for Montana. And so John Tester has an individual reputation that he protects. And so far, it's kept him alive in Montana. But this year, he's got an opponent who's sort of a younger, more vibrant version of himself with a military record. And so the things come together in the sense of the partisanship of Montana and the sort of freshness of his opponent means that he's likely to lose. Joe Manchin didn't think he was going to win in West Virginia for the same reason. So when you look at the rest of the Senate, Tammy Baldwin's been elected twice before in Wisconsin. Sherrod Brown's been elected several times in Ohio. And these states are, Ohio's gone red, but Sherrod Brown hangs on because people know him and they think he's worked hard for what they need. And so he may likely win. Same with Bob Casey in Pennsylvania. So that's the difference between the House, where we talk about partisan fortunes, and the Senate, where we talk about individual Senate reputation and can they hang on even if their state moves to a, more towards the opposite party.
Right. So, Sherrod Brown, I think in particular, is that example where Ohio used to be a swing state and is now solidly red, but he remains popular by sort of distancing himself from the party on some key issues.
But delivering. But we would agree that he delivers on things like unions, labor rights, occupational safety, education. He tries to sort of really get at the issues that he thinks most voters in Ohio experience, right? So he's sort of a down-to-earth kind of a ruffle-headed, kind of guy. And that I think has helped him maintain that persona. And this is going to 2024 is a real test now. I think you and I can agree on whether the Senate itself now provides any opportunities for people to make their own reputations anymore, or is it so partisan that they can't escape the party label no matter what?
Right. I mean, in 2022, sort of party line voting in US Senate records hit a record high. So we'll see what happens in 2024. But what about some of these states that actually are red when it comes to electing the president, but actually have somewhat competitive Senate races? So I'm thinking of Florida, I'm thinking of Texas, I'm thinking of Nebraska. Do Democrats have any chances there when we're looking at a West Virginia and a Montana that will surely flip from blue to red?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I do think that this year there is a hidden women's abortion vote. Just like in 2022, I think commentators underestimated the power of abortion. Florida has abortion on the ballot, and this is a real choice for women for reproductive rights between 6 weeks or a near total ban or 15 weeks or 16 weeks. I think that will make that Senate race much tighter because I do see women going in and saying, I'm voting for reproductive rights, and I realize that the female Senate candidate is going to work to protect that. So I think that's going to be even closer. Plus, Rick Scott, like Ted Cruz, is really interesting if you're a real political junkie, disliked personally, but gets reelected, was governor and got elected to the Senate, but people don't like him. And Ted Cruz, the same thing in Texas. Everyone says they don't like Ted Cruz, yet he still wins reelection. Ted Cruz is, I think it's a tougher climb for Democrats in Texas. Beto O'Rourke came close. I think Colin Allred may come close. But in the end, I do think Ted Cruz delivers for Texas. I think he's always made sure, despite his time, filibustering and talking on the Senate floor, to really lean in and try to provide things for Texas. So I'm not sure they can really overcome that. Nebraska is interesting, and I'll ask you this and our audience this. You have someone who's really competitive against Republican incumbent Deb Fischer, who may win. We can talk about gender dynamics there as an independent, but who will he caucus with? I mean, my guess is that he caucuses with the Republicans if he's the decider, or if he gives them a more comfortable margin because he can extract more from the party, like being on the Agriculture Committee, and do things for Nebraska. So this is going to be an interesting thing. I don't think it's going to help the Democrats necessarily.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And Nebraska is interesting in this election for all sorts of reasons. We also have sort of the blue dot effort because Nebraska is one of only two states that does not have a winner-take-all system for their electoral college votes. They do winner-take-all for the two that go to the senators. And then for each congressional district, it can go for either presidential candidate, depending on who gets the majority in that congressional district. So that Omaha district in Nebraska is competitive at the House level, competitive at the presidential electoral college level. And of course, that extra mobilization probably makes the Senate race a little bit more competitive as well, in what we think of as being a pretty solidly red state.
Which is a great point I want to share, and then we can switch again back to Congress. But I think thinking about the Electoral College, this is an example where if you split up and you proportionally allocate the Electoral College delegates, like Nebraska does and Maine does, people turn out to vote. people from both parties turn out to vote because they don't say, oh, well, it's a blue state or a red state, I'll stay home. They realize that their vote counts in actually dividing up these delegates. So if we had that across the country, I think the Electoral College wouldn't be so vilified. It would also better reflect people's preferences.
I agree to some level with the important caveat that the Senate malapportionment that exists now would, disadvantage Democrats when it comes to the Electoral College vote, and the gerrymandering, whether done by sort of elected state legislatures and governors or by the sort of natural, more efficient districts that Republicans hold than Democrats, as Democrats are more likely to be concentrated with big margins in urban districts, and Republican seats are a little bit more evenly spread out, that would that type of electoral college reform would disadvantage Democrats pretty much in the same way that the current system disadvantages Democrats. But electoral college reform is a different topic for a different day. But anything else about the Senate? Obviously, these competitive races are being flooded by money from outside groups and the parties, that the candidates aren't lacking funds to get their message across. But what observations are you making about the campaigns in terms of campaign
Well,
spending or issues?
I'm thinking to myself about Jackie Rosen in Nevada, and I'm thinking about Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, and Alyssa Slotkin in the open seat in Michigan. And when you think about Jackie Rosen, it's under the radar. I mean, Nevada's neck and neck between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, but Jackie Rosen, last I checked, had at least a 6 to 9 point lead over her opponent, and we haven't heard much about her. And, so Catherine Cortez Masto had a tough race also in 2022 and won bigger than people thought. So I'm looking at the way that women running for Senate are activating women voters and how, if Alyssa Slotkin wins by 4% in Michigan and Kamala Harris only wins, if she wins Michigan, by 0.5%, what is it about being a female senator? What are they doing to solidify their position? She comes from the House, Alyssa Slotkin, but Tammy Baldwin's been delivering and so is Jackie Rosen. And when you, I think about that, and then because I think about the sort of what makes a female senator unique in a campaign. If it was a male senator, would they be more vulnerable to partisanship? Would they be less able to be flexible? This is really a year where women have been flexing their electoral power, as you well know, so much more intensely and considerably and effectively in the last 6 years. Will this happen again? And so that's what I'm watching, thinking, is it that she's been loyal, that she's delivered, that she's good on women's issues, theoretically, Tammy Baldwin, let's say, in Wisconsin? So I think that Russ Feingold couldn't hold on as a very liberal Democrat. And then he ran again and he lost in 2016. But the issue is why would Tammy Baldwin get elected again and again in a state where a liberal Democratic male couldn't hold on? And I think that says something about the difference about women senators from male senators. And as Minnesota knows, you have two female senators, and they're very different in their styles. And they have been very successful electorally, but I still think there's something extra women have to do to hang on vis-a-vis men.
Well, I think that's right. And, research shows that in recent cycles, Democratic women actually have been more likely to win primaries than Democratic men have. So there's, certainly I think that the support from the party is really important. But in the case of an Alyssa Slotkin, who currently is in the House, she has this strong military background and has really been a moderate, which is, of course, the appropriate model for Michigan. We know that women on average introduce more bills or sort of more legislatively active. And I think, that there's a sort of relationship to campaign activities as well, but I think deserves further research. So.
Yeah, we haven't really thought about this. You and I haven't talked about it a lot, but when we think about women governors, we're still so, 25 US senators are women, but I think the number, are we up to 9 maybe for female governors? Is it more, 9 or 10? That's not a lot, right? No. So, and we have people who've been getting reelected, like New Mexico, and then Kathy Hochul took over the special seat, with the resignation of Andrew Cuomo and won reelection in New York State. But I wonder why. What are those hurdles? You have Moore Healey in Massachusetts. What are the hurdles for women to run for governor? And why do they seem to be much more significant than running for Senate? So I just think that's something, if you're interested in gender politics and interested in executive governance, even Kamala Harris running for president, is there something that voters are still resistant to when they think about women at the executive level?
That is such a great question. And Minnesota is a striking example of that, right? We have two popular female senators, Senator Klobuchar and Senator Smith. Senator Klobuchar is actually up for re-election this cycle, but we're not talking about that because she is, not on anyone's radar. That seat is ranked as a solidly safe seat for Democrats. But Minnesota has never elected a woman as governor. Now, if the Harris-Walz team wins, Peggy Flanagan, the lieutenant governor, will become governor, and also not only Minnesota's first woman governor, but the first Native governor as well. So that would be another milestone. But that is an interesting question. So let's talk about some numbers. So thinking about women running for the Senate, there are nine incumbent women running, six women running for open seats, and six women running as challengers. And of the women running as challengers, there are three Republicans and three Democrats. But of the incumbents and the women running for open seats, it's very lopsided toward Democrats. Seven Democratic women running as incumbents compared to two Republican women, five Democratic women running in open seats compared to one Republican woman. So there's also, a partisan gap when we're talking about women running for the House and Senate as well.
Right, and I wonder if it's a little bit affected this year by the fact that we have people who ran before. So in Pennsylvania, the Senate challenger to Bob Casey, McCormick, ran in the primary against Mehmet Oz in 2022 and lost. So he then sort of assumed the natural mantle of getting the nomination this time around. I don't know what to make of Mike Rogers. I mean, he didn't run before, but he's so well known in the House and touted his armed services record in Michigan. So I wonder if there would have been more room for women to run if some of the people who are running, like Carrie Lake is running again. She's a woman, but she's running again and she won that primary. If people who had not run and who had run in 22 chose not to run again, would there have been more open opportunity in both parties to run again or to run for the Senate? And the House is interesting to me when we talk about the House, because really, I don't know, we can discuss this and maybe we agree, maybe we don't. But California and New York play an outsized role in whether the majority flips, right? Because the Republicans took some seats in New York and California in 2022. But California, I was just out in California, and they are worried, not worried, but they're saying they don't think turnout's going to be very high because Adam Schiff defeated Katie Porter. So you sort of think about that gender dynamic. Again, he's running against Steve Garvey for Senate, and people think he's going to win. Right. And they think Kamala Harris is going to win. So what will the turnout be? And will that affect those sort of Orange County, San Diego, south of Los Angeles seats that are so important for the Democrats? So what's your, you hark from working for someone from that area. So what do you think can happen in an election where it's so fiercely polarized, but blue states are really going to determine control of the House?
Right. And just as you noted, California is not competitive at the presidential level. It's not competitive for the open Senate seat. And so as a result, the money and the attention that is being spent in these competitive districts in California is really focused on House races. And it's a little bit harder to get people to focus on House races if that's the most competitive game in town. But the money that is flowing into these races to the candidates' campaign committees and then also the outside money, because donors across the country from both parties know that California and New York have the lion's share of the seats that will determine majority party control of the next election. So, right, the Orange County seats. I'm thinking about, Michelle Steele, the first Korean American woman elected from Orange County. I mean, there are some really vulnerable Republicans who held on in 2022 and are now at the top of the target list. And a similar, slightly different but similar dynamic in New York. Seats that Democrats feel like in 2022, had we paid more attention to these seats in New York and these seats in California, maybe Democrats could have hung on to the majority. And certainly neither party is taking any of these competitive seats in California and New York for granted. Whereas the top of the tickets in those states, there's just not a lot of activity. But I think the path to the majority definitely runs through New York and California.
Yeah, and then of course, if the Democrats do win the House, and I think my odds are still on the Republicans retaining it with a very small majority, which should be very interesting for those of us who watch politics, because I don't think they're going to get any more unified, even under Donald Trump. But Hakeem Jeffries is from New York, and he is the Democratic leader, and he would be the Speaker, and then the second in command would be a woman from Massachusetts, Catherine Clark. So I think that That's just a really different leadership than the Republican current leadership. So, and let's say, Steve Scalise runs, let's say the Republicans lose and Steve Scalise of Louisiana runs against Jim Jordan of Ohio for the Republican leadership position. Because I think if the Republicans lose, Mike Johnson won't be the Republican leader. And I think that those of us who are looking at the election and looking at the House and the Senate in particular, there are going to be very interesting internal dynamics in the Republican Party, really fighting for the soul of the party. And how much do they, they're all going to want to pass tax cuts. But other than that, what will they do if they have to do anything on a Trump agenda, deportation, for example? What will they do and how will they do it? My prediction is that they're going to want to hold on to the House in 26. That's going to be hard to do, as we know. The out party does better in midterm elections. So I'm already thinking again ahead to the sort of policy implications of having conflict within these parties.
Agreed. It's hard to imagine sort of any more partisan drama for Republicans in the next 2 years than there have been over the previous 2 years, but agreed, it is possible. And of course, it is highly unusual for leader to resume if they're defeated, Nancy Pelosi, if their party's defeated. Nancy Pelosi was really an outlier in that. Also in the way she was really an outlier in that she had such tight discipline over her party and got a lot done, even with very, very narrow margins. Interesting that though, I mean, Steve Scalise, currently the number two Republican, has said, if Trump wins and Republicans control the House, they aren't going to make some of the same mistakes they made back in 2017, 2018, when Republicans controlled the trifecta, the White House, the House, and the Senate, and didn't get as much done as they sort of could have. They weren't really prepared to do as much. He sort of said they won't make the same mistake. But no matter which party is in the majority, as you note, the margins will be narrow. And it'll be interesting. I also want to turn to sort of the possibility of, a Harris-Waltz White House with a Republican Congress and with a Democratic Congress. So give us your thoughts there.
So, to me, the Harris-Waltz, if they win, if that team wins, I do still think the Senate goes Republican. And I think probably 51-49, if you lose Montana and you lose West Virginia. We'll see what, if Nebraska, who he caucuses with, if he wins. I see the House as really crucial to any kind of success at all for the Kamala Harris administration with Waltz, because you have to again approve the debt ceiling. You have to make sure the budget's approved. Mike Johnson's been good about that, not shutting the government down. If I think how what will they do with Harris in the in office, right? Do they think they'll get blamed for that? In the past, they were very successful electorally in 2014 after shutting it down in 2013. They were less successful in 2020, but in the House, Republicans did pretty well in 2020 after shutting the government down in 2019. So the what is the cost of shutting the government down for the Republicans if Kamala Harris is president? And if they control the Senate and the House, both chambers, I think the cost goes way up for them. If they only control the Senate and they lose the House and the minority in the House, there's no reason for them to vote to keep the government open. They only, right?
Except the Trump tax cuts will expire in the next Congress. And so that sort of gives everyone an incentive to get something done. And if
That
everything
is.
be packaged together, that might be sort of the reconciliation only need 51 votes vehicle.
That's possible. That's possible. But if a tax cut bill passes, then Kamala Harris also gets credit for keeping the Trump taxes. So it's going to be a bit of a chess match. I think that there are a lot of things the Biden administration has done legislatively that are big things, like the CHIPS bill, the Build Back Better, and the badly named Inflation Reduction Act, but they're not nearly completed, right? They require a great deal more implementation. So if you're the Harris administration, you can bypass Republican obstructionism in the House and Senate if you focus on executive implementation. If you actually really implement the laws that were passed under Biden and you make them fully effective and they are productive, then you get credit for that. And you don't need a legislative victory for that. So I don't see, I think John Lewis Act for voting rights, I think they'll resurrect, they'll push hard. I also think the Democrats will introduce a guaranteed right to abortion. So the Republicans will do a national abortion ban, the Democrats will do a guaranteed right to abortion, and she'll push that hard. But I don't see her pushing a lot of new things in the agenda because you're going to get bogged down. So why not use as much executive power to implement things that people can see and touch and experience, and then give you credit for.
Yeah. So play out either scenario, Republicans have the trifecta, unified party control in Washington, or Democrats have unified party control? Does either party, do both parties get rid of the legislative filibuster?
This is an excellent question, Professor Pearson, because I've been thinking about this. So this is my scenario. The Republicans take the Senate 51-49. That means that then in order to reduce the threshold to shut down a filibuster on a legislative initiative, they only need 51 votes to pass that. In other words, to uphold a ruling of the chair that says 51 votes will shut down the filibuster rather than sorry, that was my notification. 51 votes rather than the 60 that we need now. So what happens if something comes up and the Republicans say we want to shut down the legislative filibuster? Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine, are more moderate Republicans. Lisa Murkowski just won re-election. Susan Collins won a couple of years before. They're both in their mid-70s. I don't know if they're running again. They will become the absolutely most important pivots in the Senate, and I don't see a day where they will vote to get rid of the legislative filibuster. The other thing is political cover. I don't think the majority of members of the Senate in the Republican Party want to vote for a national abortion ban. I don't think so. The House may be a little bit different, but I don't think they do. I think a lot of them are consensus around 16 weeks. So if it's a complete ban, they're going to need some cover. And if the House passes it and sends it to the Senate and Democrats filibuster it, then you want that. If you're a Republican senator, maybe up for re-election in 26, you don't ever want to vote on that bill. You're very happy to see it filibustered. So I think the particular politics of the bills that they might want to get passed to and then they would say we want to get rid of the legislative filibuster are bad politics for a number of Republican senators. And they're going to want the excuse of blaming the Democrats for obstruction. But to do that, they're going to have to keep the legislative filibuster. And that's the scenario I think playing out. That's what I think will play out at least the first 6 to 8 months of the Congress.
Among Republicans, and then,
Yes.
but Democrats could be a different story.
Democrats are not going to get rid of the legislative filibuster. I think the Democratic majority has taken a lot of steps since 2008, really, but also 2013 to really package bills that don't that make sure that senators can't offer a lot of amendments. And wasn't it Dave Durenberger used to offer a whole lot of amendments? If he wasn't getting what he wanted on the Agriculture Committee and the Appropriations Committee, he would offer amendments on the floor, but you can't do that much anymore. They really tightly control it. So it's hard to make a reputation, hard to get any kind of press. What do? You make speeches. What do? You filibuster. Paul Wellstone obviously was very good at filibustering, senator from Minnesota. So thinking about that, why would you vote away your own incentive to get name recognition and be the hero on filibustering? So I don't see, even if, let's say some weird thing happened where the Senate kept was Democrat and when Trump wins the White House, I don't know how that happens, but if that ha were to happen, I think, oh, would they, Republicans won't want to filibuster because Trump's going to want to get stuff done. So I just don't see a scenario where the Democrats think it's appealing to shut down the filibuster.
Thank you. That interesting. I mean, certainly it seemed like if there had been 51 Democrats willing to do it the first 2 years of the Biden term, there were a lot of Democrats, who wanted to pass those key bills like the John Lewis voting rights bills, et cetera. But obviously, even though Democrats had the majority, not all Democrats were in favor of getting rid of it. I've sort of viewed it as inevitable at some point, but maybe not in the next Congress.
Yeah, I mean, everyone thinks that, and then they get there, the senators, and then they realize, oh, this is kind of good that I have this power. And look at how much, Cruz and Josh Hawley and Mike Lee and Rand Paul get for blocking up the Senate. The other thing about the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, is that it seems like a very good piece of legislation, but I do think that it will be challenged, and this Supreme Court might strike it down. So if they strike it down and you've given up the filibuster just to pass it, you have to ask yourself that question. Now, they can reinstate the right to filibuster. It's just a ruling of the chair. So this is something that in my day, we never really thought that the rules would change that much in the Senate. Because the Senate is a standing body where the rules persist Congress to Congress, the House rewrites its rules, as you well know, every 2 years. So I think that's what's changing is the rules are changing fast, but whatever they get rid of, they can always bring back.
Right. That's an excellent point. And for any students out there, I always like to remind people that the filibuster is not in the Constitution.
Neither is the right to vote.
There's a lot of lore. So, Okay, I'm going to turn some questions from the audience, some of which we have covered. And here's a question from one of our guests. This conversation seems to frame 2024 as a normal election, yet both sides are portraying the other as an existential threat to the country, even though only one candidate actually attempted to overturn an election in 2020. What do you make of this rhetoric, and where do you see it leading, especially if Trump is elected?
I think each party has done a really good job of demonizing the other candidate. I mean, really, I think there are a lot of people in America that believe that the Democratic Party has gone, what, quote unquote, too far left, that they'll, open up all our borders and give away all of our money and forgive student loans and do things for other people. Remember, 60% of people don't go to college and 40% do. So I think the Democrats have been labeled that way. And so if you are somebody who can't benefit from any of those things or you have concerns about border security, you really do believe that it's, a massive threat that the country will fall apart if Kamala Harris is elected. Do I think that's the reality? I don't. If Trump is elected, I think the argument about democracy and democratic norms, I think I've been thinking and thinking about this. I do think that it's the core of the American people that support that. I don't think a politician, one way or the other, can actually prop it up or destroy it entirely. Trump didn't do those things, partially because there were things in his way in his first term. And so I don't know how effective he'll be in doing them in the second term. So if he doesn't succeed in backing up his rhetoric, then you can understand why people think, well, no, he's not really a threat to democracy. But even the simple refusal to concede the election in 2020, the simple refusal to uphold tradition and greet the incoming president. I mean, these erode our norms. These erode our peaceful transfer of power, much less January 6th. So there is a danger if it becomes, where you're, oh, you stole the election, or I'm gonna not gonna certify ballots that were legally and fairly cast, then the nuts and bolts of democracy start to unravel. And so that's the concern of re-electing somebody who's been quite blunt about not abiding by any of those things. Do I think every single person who votes with Donald Trump doesn't believe in democracy? I don't think that. I just don't. But I do think that he has successfully argued that government is working for other people and not you to his base. It's not true, but it is perceived to be true. And in some cases, if you're getting a student loan forgiven, I didn't go to college, I'm not getting that benefit. So I do think that it will be up to, I go back to Tocqueville, it will be up to every community, every county, every city, every state to make sure to preserve fundamental civil liberties and civil rights. And maybe we've been relying on the government to do that for us for too long. And now we have to go back and say to ourselves, the country barely elected somebody who doesn't respect these norms. We have to fight again for these norms and these values. And that's a scary proposition, but we've had to do it before. And I think the country is fully capable of resisting a lot of the worst tendencies of authoritarianism. Federalism helps a great deal. Federalism gets in the way of implementation of policy, as you and I have talked about, but federalism helps a lot when the federal government wants to do something that is kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously January 6th, 2025 is something that Congress will be prepared for. But speaking of federalism, do you worry about December 17th in the swing states where the elections are close, sort of the day the electors are certified in each state?
I mean, I do worry about that. I think governors and secretaries of state are and state police are going to have to really be thinking about that. The difference for the Democrats is that you have leadership in some states that is Democrat, right? So Arizona now has a Democratic governor and a Democratic secretary of state, I believe. And then Nevada has a Republican governor. But I don't know the Secretary of State affiliation. I think it's Democrat. And then Michigan has Democrat governor, Democrat Secretary of State, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. So when you think about the infrastructure that has to make sure that these electoral college votes are taken, are affirmed, and are then safely transported to Washington, that most of the swing states, and it looks like North Carolina will likely have a Democratic governor in January, most of them are inclined to make sure that happens at all costs. And Brian Kemp, Republican, and Brad Raffensperger, Secretary of State in Georgia, have proven under enormous pressure that they will do the same. So I'm not as worried about that. I do think that it's a scary sight when you have to have so many police surrounding people doing their democratic and civic duty. January 6th is interesting. I'm just getting this straight in my head because I think it's important for our viewers and our listeners that the change in the law that the Democrats did is so crucial because now you need a lot more people to object to certification of electoral college results, but in order to fully reject them, you need majority of both chambers to actively reject as opposed to approve. And I think that makes all the difference because I think if the Republicans won the House back, they would not approve the certification of the Electoral College. And my guess is they will vote to reject it if they are in the majority. And it will be, and but you have to have the Senate do that too. And I don't think the Senate will do that. Again, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and people like Jim Lankford and some other people are probably going to vote the way that the Electoral College turns out. But that change really stabilizes that procedure. Whereas I think it could have, if they hadn't made that change, it could have been very unstable.
Right. And to be specific, you're talking about the Electoral College Count Act that was passed in the last Congress and signed into law by President Biden. Yeah, which is really important. It also clarifies the role of the vice president as well. You mentioned partisan gerrymandering earlier. We have a question about partisan gerrymandering and its impact on legislative races across the United States and also on the U.S. House. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, and especially looking at th this current cycle?
Well, so the history of gerrymandering goes back to the 1830s, late 1820s, 1830s, when I believe a Whig, I think Eldridge Gerry was a Whig, I'll double check, was governor of Massachusetts. And he figured out that, hey, you could draw these district lines for the House in really interesting ways, and they don't have to be contiguous, and we can slant them towards our own party. And that's what gerrymandering is, a state legislature. 14 or 15 states have independent commissions. That and some are binding and some recommend a particular map. But we've seen case after case after case, North Carolina, Alabama, Pennsylvania, where the state legislature will draw very interesting geographic lines around districts to carve out majority Republican or majority Democrat, mostly majority Republican in those cases, districts that don't make any sense. Hamilton said a member of the House shall have a habitual recollection of their dependence on the people and shall represent a district that looks like them, meaning that's where they come from, not all carved up. So that has been a tool used for so long, I mean, almost, 190 years or 180 years to solidify the advantage for the majority party in a state legislature. The one instances or the two instances we saw in 1994 and 2006 where they overcame gerrymandering. Right. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans won 50, they defeated 52 incumbents. They won 73 seats in 1994. And Nancy Pelosi won a ton of seats in 2006. And that's where there are other districts. And there was just a national issue that was so unpopular. They had a set of issues. And they managed to use the vote to overcome the imbalance in number of registered Democrats and Republicans. What's interesting now, I think, Professor Pearson, going into the next couple of elections, is that now we have more registered Republicans in the country than registered Democrats. We also have more registered independents, than we ever used to have. So does that change the calculation on redistricting when in fact it seems as if people are sorting more heavily into particular parties? And so that may not turn out to be as big a force in the next couple of House cycles because people themselves are changing their party affiliation.
That's excellent points. And it's also worth noting that an increasing number of states, particularly those with the initiative process, are going their own way. So, California, through the initiative process, passed its redistricting reform. So now a panel does this without regard to party. And it's produced some of these more competitive districts that we were talking about earlier. Minnesota, although actually the first cut is, the legislature to the governor. For the last three cycles, we've wound up with judicial panels because of divided government. But it's also worth noting that, the partisan polarization exists not purely because of gerrymandered. The partisan polarization in the Senate is rampant as well. And, there's no partisan gerrymandering in the Senate. So it is just a feature of our modern political system, which we need to deal with. So a few of our questioners have asked about sort of Congress and the legislative process, sort of bemoaning the fact that both parties are more extreme, sort of the MAGA coalition among Republicans and, very progressive Democrats on the Democratic side, and that that precludes bipartisan cooperation and makes it harder to get things done. And another questioner asks, if you're in the minority party, can you get anything done? So if you could sort of tackle those questions, and I'll weigh in as well.
I think it, part of how we interpret whether people are extreme or not are how they vote on choices. And so for me, the way that our House and Senate work, the choices are funneled to members when they vote. They go through leadership, they go through committees, then they go through leadership, and they're funneled to be quite partisan, except in the details of the bills. So the choice is usually yes or no. With my party, against my party. It's also funneled that there isn't a lot of opportunity to express opinions in the middle. And I think we also mistake the past, the interpreting of the past, to think people were more moderate because Democrats were Southern conservative dominated, right? So from 1954 all the way to 1994, the South had white male conservatives dominating their Democratic Party, and they were not liberal people. So they were not that far away from Republicans who are fiscally conservative and maybe a little bit more socially moderate. So now with the, gradual flipping of the South from Democrat to Republican and the strong conservative social influences there, it looks quite divided. And it looks as if, oh, they were much more moderate and more compromisey, 40 years ago. But that's only because the Democrats were more conservative in the South. So they looked like they compromised, but they weren't really compromising. They agreed with the Republicans on a lot of issues. Now, with the rise of urban populations and the changing of the West and the Midwest and the Northeast really to solid Democrat, then I think now you bring back in regional differences, urban-rural differences, and diversity differences. And so I think that's what's pushed the Democrats, which have always been kind of an urban-based party, to be more liberal because they have constituencies that are really different than they were 50 years ago or even 80 years ago. And so I'm not sure that there's no in-between or middle ground in the real world, but the way that they're asked to cast their legislative votes forces them to be either or one way or the other.
Absolutely. And it used to be the case that the House Rules Committee would allow many amendments on bills. And now members of Congress have virtually no opportunity to amend a bill in the House of Representatives. And even in the free-flowing Senate, it's much harder as well, as Professor Schiller has documented. So the dynamics, sort of the legislative process are different. Both parties are more internally homogeneous and farther apart from one another. And then the base of the Democratic Party has, of course, changed, certainly with the realignment of the South into a two-party system, but also even since 2016, when we used to look at sort of white, non-college educated voters who would sort of break for Republicans and Democrats at roughly equal rates. And now there's a lot more support from whites without college degree for Republican candidates. And then you have sort of whites with college degrees who are breaking more for Democrats. And so there's also this shift in the party coalition there, which I think sort of affects the policymaking process as
Yeah, it
well.
definitely pushed. I agree with you. I think that the fact that the Democrats now win 60% of people with college education, that really confuses the Democratic Party messaging because those voters now tend to be more liberal. 34 years ago, people with college education were more Republican. And so that pushes more liberal, and then still they need the loyalty of people who are middle or lower working class income people to win elections, and they need union workers. And but things like affordable housing, that's dividing those college educated elite Democrats now. At least in the Northeast, we have circumstances where people vote liberally, but if you want to put affordable housing in their neighborhood, they say no. So it's not as smooth a transition for the Democrats on their policy positions, implementing those policies, more Healey, the governor of Massachusetts, facing this, as it is in speech. So this is also a big problem. And we can't not talk about Trump's effect here. What Trump has done is instead of saying, I'm Republican, you're a Democrat, we don't agree, it's almost like there's a loyalty test. And people who have fallen really love Trump have decided that you're either with me and with him and his vision of America, or you're not patriotic, or you're not my friend, or he has had a more divisive, polarizing effect than I think people expected him to have when he won in 2016. You know, using a particular language is one thing, but actually getting into the psyche of people where they won't, you know, they describe people with an adjective. It's a Trumper. I never heard somebody say Obama-er or a Clinton-er or a Bush-er, but this is a Trumper. And so this has changed our politics, and I think it has made things a bit more entrenched than we anticipated.
Absolutely. And it certainly affected the House and the Senate in the way they operate as well, as did January 6th. I mean, Democrats said after January 6th, you know, some of their Republican colleagues made them feel literally unsafe. And so, as you know, you and I well know, partisan polarization started well before 2016. It started with the realignment of the South in the 1970s and has just crept up. But Trump really exacerbated and just, you know, this competitive and acerbic dynamic is really, really troubling. Sort of thinking about quickly going
But wait,
back
can
to
I just add one more thing? But
yes.
so we're not depressed, so we don't get walk away depressed or anything. It's troubling. I agree with you, but I think it's surmountable. And I think we just have to resort to treating people like they're human beings, and we don't know their backstories, right? So I like to tell people, if you're gonna get on a plane, a plane, a bus, train, it's a good movie, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles, but you don't ask somebody what their partisan affiliation is the minute you sit down. You say, oh, you're going into Cleveland. What are you doing? Visiting family? Do you know a place good to eat? People have more in common with each other than the parties want you to believe, or that the media and social media companies want you to believe. And I think if we just take a step back and remember that in our personal interactions, we can, you know, sort of fight against these really loud, you know, noisy tendencies that divide us. So I do think we're capable of resisting. We just have to consciously kind of do more of that.
Absolutely agree. And increasing the number of competitive House districts would really help as well. Because if you look at the, you know, 24, there are 24 toss-up races, according to the Cook Political Report in the House. And if you look in the at the incumbents who represent many of those, they're the most likely to introduce bipartisan legislation, most likely to work across the aisle. You know, their voting records are still pretty partisan, but their rhetoric is different, their legislation is different, their cooperation with members across the aisle is different. And so, you know, these incentives matter as well. You know, Minnesota's second district is the only real competitive House race. Some are sort of, you know, slightly competitive, but it is the most competitive, I should say. And, you know, the incumbent Angie Craig has made a real point of sort of acting in a bipartisan way, but it's competitive because it's a swing district. You know, the voter, you know, party identification is nearly evenly divided. Thinking about our questions from our audience, the Supreme Court has ruled that the president has full immunity. How does this affect Congress's role? What does this mean for oversight in legislating?
Well, this is a very controversial decision, and people feel strongly about it on all sides. You know, the founders put in the entire impeachment process because I don't think they relied on the judicial process of prosecution to control a president. You know, I think they knew that from the beginning that this would be a difficult thing to do, and they didn't want repeated prosecutions of ex-presidents. And let's think about the conflictual presidents that, you know, were our early presidents. Washington was relatively neutral, but John Adams did a lot of things that people might say, "Ooh, gee, maybe we should put him in jail for that." And then Thomas Jefferson did some things, and they hated each other, although they reconciled in the end of their lives. So, you know, would Adams have put Jefferson in jail or Jefferson put Adams in jail? I think they saw that as a possibility and they want to avoid it. So I think they left impeachment in because they said a duly elected legislature, the House and the Senate, deciding that a president's unfit would be the most legitimate, fair way to deny a president the opportunity to stay in office or run for office again. So I do think it goes in line. Now you have a circumstance where a president has actually been, you know, indicted on multiple different accounts and different charges. And the court has said, I think, it's impractical. You know, who's going to decide, you know, what if you use drones to kill, quote unquote, our enemies in a foreign country, and then it turns out you didn't kill our enemies, you killed other people, can you be charged with murder? I mean, if the president is not immune, then the president may not be able to make decisions that they need to make. I mean, I actually buy that part of the argument. I think the president can be prosecuted for personal or civil crimes, after he or she is out of office. And I think there's some room in the Supreme Court decision for that to happen. I think it's going to have to play out, and we'll have to see what happens. But there's an argument to be made that if the founders looked at that decision, they'd say, we kicked the can down the road. We didn't grapple with this, and we left you an imperfect system. But in the end of the day, a president's crimes against the people, are the most important crimes we worry about. And that's where an impeachment system is probably a failure because of the threshold to convict is just too high.
Yeah. And as you note, it will play out. How do you think that efforts over the past several years intended to disenfranchise voters or increase voter security and the removal of people from voter rolls will impact the election, both at the national level and in these congressional elections?
We just saw the Supreme Court just said, yes, Virginia can kick people off. I mean, Brian Kemp, he behaved pretty well in 2020 as governor, but when he was Secretary of State running for governor in 2018, he disenfranchised, I think, 53,000 people towards the election, and 2/3 were black voters in Georgia. I never trust politicians who claim in the name of democracy they want to limit my right to vote or anybody else's right to vote, or that they claim you're illegitimate when you're voting. If you were, I just don't trust them on that, whether the Democrats or Republicans. People say you must be a citizen. Of course, you must be a citizen to vote. We have voter ID in Rhode Island. I think it's legitimate to say, okay, you need to say that you are who you are and you live in the district and you can vote. I think that's totally legitimate. Voter registration, as we both know, was initially enacted in the late 19th century, early 20th century as a voter suppression tool, particularly in the South, but also in the North. If you force people to register, then you know who they are. You know how to campaign to them. You know how to serve them. You don't have a lot of uncertainty in the election because you can pre-gauge what people want because they've registered to vote. I don't understand why anyone has to really register to vote. You just show your ID and where you live and you're who you are. So I am not a fan of any of these measures, and I don't think that they actually help democracy. And I think the whole question of voter fraud is totally overblown and been used as a political cudgel. And remember, when you join forces with people who want to limit access to voting, you give them the power to limit access for you to vote. And so that's why I don't like it.
Yeah. Well put. And of course, Minnesota was one of the early adopters of same-day registration. There is no systematic evidence of fraud, and Minnesota, consistently leads the nation in voter turnout in both presidential and midterm election years. And so, reducing the barriers to voting is really important, and there's no systematic evidence that it produces fraud.
I
So,
think isn't it over 70% in Minnesota or something? It's
in
really
presidential,
high.
yeah,
Yeah,
it's
really,
amazing.
really very impressive.
Amazing. So, and we'll see what effect, Walz at the top of the ticket has. I mean, it has certainly energized Democrats in Minnesota, and it has certainly brought out criticism from Republicans in Minnesota. So everyone in Minnesota is talking about it in one way or the other. And we only have a few minutes left. I do want to ask you what you think the effect of having a former House member as vice president in the White House would be. Tim Walz represented the first district of Minnesota from he was elected in 2006 until 2018. And we've had a lot of senators. But what do you think about a House member?
I think it'll be very good for presidential congressional relations, even if it's a divided government. I think, Biden played a similar role for Obama. Obama was only in the Senate for, a hot second, and Biden was there for many years. And he really was the liaison that helped get a lot of things done. So I think knowing the House, knowing the pressures House members are under, I think can be really a powerful tool should Harris Waltz win. So I think it'll only be a bonus, for productivity and for the administration if they win.
Great. Thank you. And in our concluding minute, anything I should have asked you that you want to convey to our audience that I didn't?
I still retain a great deal of faith in the American democracy. It's been through a lot of crises in its past. It's been totally imperfect when it was founded, denied people rights, human rights, civil rights, voting rights. And over time, even though it's been messy and too long, we keep getting to places where we have more freedom, more liberty, more rights. And we just have to keep them in mind and protect them and realize that the country is bigger than any one presidential candidate or presidential campaign. So I hope people can keep that in mind. I gather Minnesotans are good at this, but not everybody around the country follows their lead. Then we just have to keep it in mind. Stay calm and carry on.
Right. Thank you. Do you think voter turnout nationally will be high this year?
I do actually think it'll be high. Maybe not in California as much, but I do think it's going to be high. We've seen extraordinarily high early voting. And so even in the state of Rhode Island, we've had a lot of early voting. So I do think it'll be pretty high.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for this, excellent conversation. I've learned a lot. I know our guests have learned a lot. We really very much appreciate it. A video recording of this program will be available 1 to 2 days after today at the link you see on the screen. This program will also be available in podcast form on all of your favorite podcast platforms and can be found by searching Dialogue Across Difference. We recommend subscribing to our podcast so you don't miss any of our event recordings. So, Professor Wendy Schiller, thank you so much for a really enlightening conversation. Appreciate it so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for letting me participate.
Thank you. And thanks again to our excellent questions and excellent audience.